The sounds and the voices you are about to hear all are real, recorded on the scene of major news events by NBC reporters throughout the world. These sounds and these voices made the high spots in the news during 1951. And here to bring them to you is Robert Trout.
You may recall that late this year, educational authorities in Los Angeles gave a simple test to 14,000 high school students. They discovered that an astonishing percentage were unable to tell the time of day. Listen to this young lady.
Well, maybe I don't know how to tell time yet. So what? My folks won't give me a watch till I graduate anyway.
Young lady, whoever you are not alone. This was the year nobody could tell what time it was. This was the year a congressional hearing became a vaudeville spectacle, and a vaudeville performer made serious theater news. This was the year we couldn't find the price of a 3-pound beefsteak, but somehow found millions of dollars to invest with a criminal gambling syndicate. For the next hour, we'll bring you some of the highlights of this year on Voices and Events 1951. We'll start with the story that shocked the nation from January to December. Here is our Dean of Commentators, H.V. Kaltenborn.
This year, we Americans learned that we have nurtured a new major industry almost without knowing it. This industry pays no taxes, responds to no government authority. How could this happen? One answer came from a St. Louis citizen. His name is James Carroll. He calls himself a betting commissioner. Listen to him as he testifies before the Kefauver Crime Committee.
I think gambling is a biological necessity for certain types. I think it is the quality that gives substance to their daydreams.
Perhaps that was part of the answer. In a hard, practical world, we Americans are spending too much time on our daydreams. We discovered that the gambling industry is run by shrewd, practical men. Men like Frank Erickson, who was brought out of a New York prison to testify before the Kefauver Committee.
I refuse to answer on the grounds of my intent to incriminate me.
Was it $169,000, 1948?
I refuse to answer on the grounds of my intent to incriminate me.
Well, you don't want to change your mind and really tell us some information which would be very useful to you, do you, Mr. Erickson?
I have no information to be useful.
One by one, like Damon Runyon characters, they came before the Kefauver Committee and astounded and shocked the nation's huge radio and television audience. We heard such unlikely names as Dandy Phil Castell and Greasy Thumb Guzik. Here, too, was Joe Adonis, reputedly a big shot in Murder Incorporated.
I decline to answer that question, Senator, on the grounds of my intent to incriminate me.
Mr. Adonis, were you ever partner or have any interest in the Piping Rock Casino at Saratoga?
I decline to answer that question, Senator, on the grounds of my intent to incriminate me.
The Kefauver hearings became a great public spectacle. In New York City, the show reached its dramatic climax with the appearance of one Frank Costello. He came to testify with a bad cold and an air of defiance. The television cameras were told to avoid his face, so they played over his twitching hands.
Under no condition will I testify from herein until I'm well enough.
You refuse to testify further?
Absolutely. Mr. Halley, am I a defendant in this courtroom?
No.
Am I under arrest?
No.
Mr. Halley, all due respect to the Senate, which I have an awful lot of respect for, I'm not going to answer another question. You just says I'm not under arrest and I'm going to walk out.
The evidence indicated that Frank Costello was head man in a nationwide gambling syndicate. It was the aim of committee counsel Rudolph Halley to show the close relations between gamblers and politicians. Deftly, with disarming amiability, he led Costello to his point.
Well, you believe it or not, I've met these people, had drinks with them, but I absolutely divorced myself from any participating in politics.
Well, you've continued to associate very closely with a great many people in politics, haven't you?
Well, I don't know if you call it associate. If I meet them, I'll talk to them, and they talk to me, and we'll have a drink or something.
Well, you had two of them up to your home for Thanksgiving dinner last Thanksgiving, didn't you?
Well, I've known them folks for over 30 years.
And
we never spoke politics.
The committee reached into national politics with the appearance of William O'Dwyer, now our ambassador to Mexico, former mayor of New York City. John P. Crane, president of New York City Union of Firemen, had refused to tell the committee anything about the disappearance of $135,000 from his union treasury. As indicated in his questioning of ex-Mayor O'Dwyer, Rudolph Halley thought he had a good idea of where some of that money went.
Do you know John P. Crane?
I do.
Did he, during the year 1949, ever visit you at the Gracie Mansion?
I don't recall that.
Is it possible that he might have?
Possible.
But you have no definite recollection.
That's right.
Do you know whether Mr. Crane ever made any campaign contributions?
I don't know.
Did he ever make any to or through you?
He did not.
Then John P. Crane decided to talk. His testimony flatly contradicted that of New York City's former mayor.
You went up to the Gracie Mansion?
That's right.
And you saw Mayor O'Dwyer?
Yes, sir.
Were you alone with him?
Yes, sir.
Where did you see him?
On the porch of Gracie Mansion.
And will you tell the committee what transpired?
I told the mayor at that time that I had promised him the support of the firemen, and I offered him some evidence of that support on the occasion in the form of $10,000.
And was that in cash?
That was in cash.
What did the mayor say?
He thanked me. That was about all.
The Kefauver hearings threw the spotlight on what was to become before the year was out our most striking domestic issue. Here was not merely a matter of economics or politics. Here was a moral problem. Dubious moral practices, intensely shocking to all honest citizens, ran through the warp and woof of our national life like corrupting threads. The threads were thin, but they seemed to threaten the basic soundness of our national life. Why, for example, had the growing use of narcotics become such a problem? Narcotic agent Charles Siragusa gave one answer when he was asked how much a kilogram of heroin cost at its point of origin in Italy.
In Italy, when I was there, the clandestine price ranged from 1,000 to 1,500 American dollars for a kilo.
How much does a kilo usually sell for in this country?
Well, when the kilo's first brought into New York City, it may get as high as $6,000 wholesale price.
And out of a kilo, they could make a million pills or doses?
I'd say about a million capsules.
Making that into a million capsules, $2 a piece, would make about $2 million for an original investment, $1,500 to $1,000.
Yes, the profit's tremendous.
The profit is so tremendous that illicit drug dealers create markets for their merchandise, even among children. Listen to the testimony of this woman, herself a drug addict, who turned to crime, prostitution, and selling drugs to children just to get money to satisfy her craving.
Well, what do you think of the statement that only 154 school children are using drugs?
No, that's definitely not true. I'm no over that amount myself, and it's got worse than last year. There seems to be more young children using it, and unfortunately, I've sold myself to young children. I know for a fact.
How old were they?
17, 18 years old.
You know any younger than that who are using it?
Yes, no, girls 12 and 13 years old, smoking marijuana, taking benzodiazepines, smoking hashish, opium, sniffing heroin and cocaine.
Not only were innocent children contaminated by this chase after an easy dollar, but some of those young men, whom we have come to regard as the outstanding examples of rugged health, are athletes. Listen to this.
Come on, Andy, wake up!
Here is a basketball game in New York City at Madison Square Garden. As you can hear, the crowd is composed largely of students.
Hey, hey, take it away! Hey!
At Madison Square Garden, things have changed. If there is betting in the crowd, it is largely small change. In New York City, the professional gamblers, and some continue to do business with old clients, refuse to take a bet on a basketball game. It's too risky. In recent years, too many young athletes succumb to the temptation of easy money by accepting bribes. Bribery of athletes was developed on a nationwide scale. Yet on the credit side of American sport is that an athlete broke the case. Junius Kellogg, star center of the Manhattan College team, provided the evidence. In the dressing room, after a game, he told us how it happened.
This individual asked me if I wanted to make some money. And I asked him how. And he told me, miss a few passes now and then. Don't go up in time for the jump balls. Let the ball go over the hoop when you're going in for a layup. I was supposed to miss out. I was offered $1,000 and the fee was supposed to go up. I would be offered more, up to $15,000 and $2,000 per game. So I told him to get out. Well, I went on, and that night I didn't have much sleep because I was thinking about what should I do. The next day, I went in and told the coach. And the Sunday, the coach asked me to stop by the office in the afternoon. So not realizing what was up, I stopped in around 3:30, and the district attorney and a couple of inspectors and the coach were in the office, and they asked me to tell them exactly what happened. And I did, and that's the way it broke open.
The teams involved in the basketball scandals ranked at the very top of the sport. Long Island University, Kentucky, Bradley. A long roster of strong, healthy bodies and low, unhealthy moral standards. But if you say these men were young and inexperienced, they were victimized by their elders, no such excuse can be offered for those individuals involved in the government scandals. What excuse have they? Here was Oliver Kraft of the St. Louis office of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. This was the investigation of the RFC loan to the Lifafold Corporation.
So we went out and left to Wisconsin. Spent 5 days. And at the conclusion of that visit, I wanted to pay Mr. Blonner my part of it. And he said, no, it was already paid and wouldn't let me pay. So I don't want to be obligated to any borrower, so Mrs. Kraft and I decided to send him something. So we sent Mr. and Mrs. Bonner a gift, which I thought compensated them for the visit.
What was the gift you sent them?
The gift was ceramics that Mrs. Kraft made, handmade ceramics, very expensive.
A handmade ceramic in return for a Wisconsin vacation. Well, maybe and maybe not. Before the Lifafold investigation was over, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee had resigned because of ill health. Then there was the case of the Saxony Hotel in Florida, another RFC borrower. Here was RFC examiner Hilton Robertson.
How long were you at the Saxony Hotel, Mr. Robertson?
About 10 days, January the 29th to February the 9th, I think it was.
You and your wife and your daughter?
That's right.
Did you pay any of the bills while you were there?
I paid all meals. And I expected to pay a reasonable rate for my room. But Mr. Sachs refused to accept any money, and he issued me a courtesy card.
There was nothing directly illegal about accepting the favor, mind you, but
Mr. Robertson, did you say a moment ago that you felt there was nothing wrong with your accepting this complimentary visit from Mr. Sachs?
No, I don't see anything wrong about
it. You don't see anything wrong?
That was the heart of the issue. Government officials saw nothing wrong with accepting favors from people who wanted to do business with his office. But our citizens ask, is that a proper way to run the world's greatest public enterprise? At the least, it exemplifies low moral standards, and today the mink coat has become the symbol of unethical conduct. Thereon, Lamar Caudle, was an assistant attorney general in charge of prosecuting income tax cases. He admitted that his wife was able to buy a mink coat at wholesale with the help of a New York attorney defending a tax case that was before him.
She talked to me about it. She wanted one. She didn't hardly have a coat worth anything. She said she had some money. She wanted to go to New York and buy one. She went up there and she shopped around with Mrs. Landau. And I told her to get a coat. It'd be a pretty extravagant thing. I hope that the sweet thing wouldn't do it, but not much I could do about it.
And how much did the mink coat cost?
There seemed to be some controversy about that. She thought she paid $2,400. She knew she paid $1,500. And Mr. Landau, she told him to call her some time ago and said that she owed $900 more on the coat. And she said she can't find a record where she's paid the gentleman. And it must be so, she told me.
Well, is it your information at the present time, Mr. Cottle, that of the fur coat purchased for Mrs. Cottle, the $1,500 was paid by her and $900 was paid by Mr. Landau? Is that the situation?
That's the way I understand it now, so what she tells me. I didn't have anything to do with that dealings or negotiations or not anything. She said she believes she now owes $900 on the thing, and that knocks out the mink coat in my house. Sure does.
It seemed fantastic that a United States attorney should permit himself to become indebted to a man who had so much to gain through influence. But for some government employees, such practices had become almost a way of life. Senator Fulbright of Arkansas was among those who were thoroughly alarmed at the possible consequences.
One of the most disturbing aspects of this problem of ethical conduct is the revelation that among so many influential people, morality has become identical with legality. We are certainly in a tragic plight if the acceptable standard by which we measure the integrity of a man in public life is that he keep within the letter of the law. In recent years, I wonder if we have not unwittingly come to accept the totalitarian concept that the end justifies the means, a concept which is fundamentally and completely antagonistic to a true democratic society.
We Americans have had a good look at ourselves this year. We find we have tolerated a vicious gambling syndicate, replete with murder and corruption, the syndicate that is a government in itself. We find we have winked at friendships between public officials and criminals. We have complacently accepted a system of public administration in which political or economic influence is at a premium. What do we plan to do about it? Perhaps the answer is both as simple and as complicated as it seemed to New Hampshire Senator Charles Tobey.
Well, up in New England, we had a poet years ago. He's now dead. His name is John Greenleaf Whittier. He wrote some wonderful things in poetry, but he wrote one poem called Problems. And in this poem, he recounted all the ills of the body parting his day. And he closed with this couplet that I submit to the record here and to the people before me and over the radio and television. But solution there is none, save in the rule of Christ alone. There's the answer. When the hearts of men and women are touched, they take their inspiration from the master of men, then we'll have a righteous America and a new America, and make of this nation a nation wherein dwelleth righteousness. And before God, it's high time.
To that, I can only say, Amen.
Thank you, Mr. Kaltenborn. The big theater story of the year occurred not on one of New York's famous legitimate stages, but in the old Palace Theater, the home of Two-A-Day Vaudeville. Judy Garland brought Two-A-Day Vaudeville back to the Palace Theater, and she got a reception the like of which Broadway had not seen for years and years. It took the old-timers back to the heyday of the Cohans and the Rooneys. Judy Garland sang and sang a lot of new songs as well as some familiar ones, like this from one of her old recordings.
I still recall the thrill. I guess I always will. I hope.
Back to Judy Garland's dressing room. Her friends came to tell her how much they loved her.
I'm practically speechless. It was thrilling to watch little Judy Garland.
Well, there's the greatest personal triumph I've ever seen for an artist. Every song she sang was wonderful.
Wonderful. But I didn't expect anything else.
It was such a thrill seeing the great performer that I saw tonight.
Oh, I think she's wonderful. And I've here and I've seen her wonderful performance.
Well, I thought it was wonderful, but so did everybody else I talked to.
Judy, I love you. This was the greatest, most exciting performance I've ever seen in all of the years I've been in show business.
It was a great night, and thank you for tonight, Judy. It was wonderful. I'm so tired and so excited. I can't talk very well, I don't think. It was really the biggest, most thrilling night of my whole life.
And now, a word from Mr. Jesse W. Randall, president of the Travelers Insurance Companies. Mr. Randall.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Ever since man first devised a calendar to measure the passing days, it has been customary to pause at the end of the year to take stock. The purpose of this stock-taking, of course, is to make use of the lessons learned from past events in forming plans for the future. The business I am engaged in, the insurance business, is vitally concerned with the plans that free men make for the years ahead. Its primary purpose, in fact, is to help make men's plans work out as they should. Any man who insures is affirming his optimism that his plans will be carried out despite the adversities that the future may bring. An insurance policy is, in a sense, a vote of confidence in the future, and confidence is a much-needed attribute today. The life insurance policy implies that the company will endure, that the policyholder's family will be able to use the benefits to sustain an accustomed way of life. The various forms of casualty and fire insurance are basically symbols of faith in the essential value of property, human endeavor, and enterprise. Against the threats of a troubled world, insurance is an affirmation that our basic social and economic way of life will stand. It is very significant that America is the best insured nation in the world. By lifting the burden of risk from the individual shoulders, insurance gives imaginative and inventive men greater freedom to start new enterprises and to expand businesses to meet the needs of a growing population. But even that is not the full measure of the value of insurance to the strength and welfare of our nation. Insurance has also provided billions of dollars for the economic development of our country. This is in addition, of course, to the other billions of dollars insurance has provided in benefits and loss payments that have meant family security and business security through the years. Above all, insurance is an example of successful cooperation among free people in handling the problems that the future always brings, because that principle of working together extends to all phases of this nation's business and social life, we Americans have better reason than any other people for facing the coming year, whatever its problems, with courage and optimism. We can be sure that our plans will have the best possible chance of realization.
Thank you, Mr. Randall. Now here again is Robert Trout.
We Americans had any number of things to worry about this year, not the least of them, high prices. Here, with the story of our economic muddle in 1951, is one of NBC's top Washington correspondents, Leif Eade.
I suppose that if you had buttonholed the average Joe citizen on Main Street, USA, and asked him what he thought about the economic situation in 1951, he'd have answered you, "These prices, they're terrible." He would have agreed with this Southern housewife.
Well, I think you feel sort of lost when you come into shop. You see everything that's so high and you can't buy any of it. And you wonder why. And the average housewife doesn't know why things are so high.
Would you say that your grocery buying habits have changed a great deal over the last few months?
Considerably. I don't buy beef now. I buy very little veal. I buy no lamb. any of the things that you really need that are so expensive. You buy pork and hot dogs and hamburger and beans, things that'll fill in.
Yet in the last half of 1951 particularly, OPS had very little to do. Some prices had hit ceiling and were threatening to break through. But a lot of other prices were below ceiling. And the old-fashioned law of supply and demand was setting those prices. But controls, even though weakened somewhat, were continued. Why? Because men in charge of defense mobilization still feared the explosive danger of inflation that might come of piling production of guns on top of production of butter. Mobilization Chief Charles E. Wilson, for instance.
What about our economy in the face of such expansion, such expenditures, such use of materials? How do we keep it from running away? There is only one answer. Controls. I hate the word, so do you. But there is no other way. Voluntary methods will not work.
In the restless economy of America in 1951, there was still plenty of complaint about controls. From business, in the person of Emerson Schmidt, the chief economist for the United States Chamber of Commerce.
Price controls tend to discourage production. They tend to distort production. They tend to encourage black markets, and they have a serious effect on moral standards, where they substantially fix prices below market levels.
From organized labor in the person of George Meany of the American Federation of Labor.
We are today confronted with a price order which amounts to legalized robbery of every American consumer, together with a wage order which denies justice and fair play to every American who works for wages.
All this criticism was a result, probably, of too long delayed return to what we consider normal. In 1951, we took on, in addition, a gigantic task of rearmament. But men in Washington still felt and feel that given a break or two, we can carry this gigantic job to a successful end, then toss controls into the ash can, and with greater production of all kinds, carry both loads, guns for the military, butter for the civilians, without another inflationary explosion. Here's Price Administrator DeSalle's cautious optimism for 1952.
The cost of living had increased 8 1/10% from the advent of the Korean War until February the 15th of 1951. Since the imposition of the general ceiling price regulation, the cost of living has been held to less than a 2% increase in more than 9 months. During the year 1952, I think there is a reasonable hope of maintaining stability and preventing a ruinous inflation. It will depend a great deal on obtaining the cooperation of all parties concerned.
The cooperation of all parties concerned. That means labor, it means the businessman, it means the person we call the consumer.
One story above all others made big headlines this year. And that story, of course, was the dismissal of General MacArthur. Here to bring you the story is NBC's veteran reporter, George Hicks.
Listen to this sound. That is the Chinese Communist bugle call for attack, echoing over the icy hills of North Korea at the beginning of this year. Our tape recorders caught some American voices during a moment of near panicky retreat.
Where are you headed?
Heading south, for me.
How was the situation in Seoul when you left? Rough. They're almost on top of us now. Where do you go from here? Just going south, that's all we know. Oh, here we go. Wish you good luck, fella. So long.
During those tense weeks of retreat, there were those who said the communists might push the United Nations forces back into the sea. They got their answer from General Douglas MacArthur.
No one is going to drive us into the sea. This command intends to maintain a military position in Korea just as long as the statesmen of the United Nations decide we should do so.
South of Seoul, The United Nations line held. By the end of January, General Ridgway was ready to launch Operation Killer. The objective was no longer to reach the Manchurian border. Now the objective was to kill as many of the enemy as possible.
We're being held up by approximately an infantry company of Chinese forces. We are now placing artillery, Ricotta 75s, and mortar ammunition or mortar fire on the hill to drive these people out. After this final assault, well, I think we will be able to break out into the clear on the other side, into the flats.
We've run about 12 over the hill since we fired up 75 on that tank gun.
These shells are bringing up mushrooms of white and black smoke on the side of this brown hill ahead of us.
We ground the Chinese communists ahead of us, killing their soldiers in great numbers, destroying or capturing their equipment. But General Douglas MacArthur began to feel that this was not the way to win the war. He spoke out.
Vital decisions have yet to be made. Decisions far beyond the scope of the authority vested in me as the military commander. Decisions which are neither solely political nor solely military, but which must provide on the highest international levels an answer to the obscurities which now becloud the unsolved problems raised by Red China's undeclared war.
In the capitals of the Western world, an impression spread that General MacArthur wanted to do more in Asia than was prudent. The impression crystallized when the general wrote a letter to Congressman Joseph Martin, Republican minority leader in the House of Representatives. Congressman Martin read it on the floor.
Dear Congressman Martin, I am most grateful for your note of the 8th. It seems strangely difficult for some to realize that here in Asia is where the communist conspirators have elected to make their play for global conquest, and that we have joined the issue thus raised on the battlefield, that here we fight Europe's war with arms, while the diplomats there still fight it with words.
That was on April 5th. 6 days later, the biggest news story of the year broke wide open. President Truman's voice was firm and emphatic.
I believe that we must try to limit the war to Korea for these vital reasons: to make sure that the precious lives of our fighting men are not wasted, to see that the security of our country and the free world is not needlessly jeopardized, and to prevent a third world war. A number of events have made it evident that General MacArthur did not agree with that policy. I have therefore considered it essential to relieve General MacArthur so that there would be no doubt or confusion as to the real purpose and aim of our policy.
It is perhaps difficult now to remember the violent passions of that moment. We were a divided nation, and in Washington the division was roughly along party lines. Listen to the bitter voice of Congressman Joe Martin.
It is a black page in American history when a Dean Acheson triumphs and a Douglas MacArthur falls.
And here is Democratic Senator Ernest McFarland.
The civilian, not the military, must be the source of final authority, or we would have fallen under military dictatorship long ago.
There was something akin to frenzy in the greeting General MacArthur received from the American people. It was as if a great dam had stored up so much emotion that it simply had to burst forth. NBC correspondent Merrill Muller was at the airport when the MacArthurs arrived in San Francisco.
The General and Mrs. MacArthur are now walking directly in front of me. The 6th Army flag is dipped in salute to General MacArthur, and the Stars and Stripes wave in this soft night air while a 3/4 moon beams down from above. And it's a perfect evening for General MacArthur's arrival home. Here is General MacArthur. General MacArthur.
I can't tell you how good it is to be home. The long, long, dreary years, Mrs. MacArthur and myself have talked and thought about this moment. But now that it's come, the marvelous hospitality,
and the wonderful reception that this great city has given us has made it seem even more delightful than we had anticipated. Thanks, we'll not forget it.
This was the hero of the Pacific, who had not set foot on American soil for 20 years. Every city in the nation wanted to do him honor, wanted to look at him and hear him speak, wanted to feast him, wanted to parade for him. There was something close to ecstasy in the voices of those who had come near him. Listen to some of the voices.
Oh, it's just marvelous. I've never seen anything like it in my life. It's the biggest day I've ever been at.
My reaction is the greatest man that ever lived, a soldier and a gentleman.
Oh, let's not forget General MacArthur and all the wonderful work that he's done.
For many people, the big moment of the year was hearing General MacArthur speak to Congress, the speech in which he justified his actions on military grounds and ended his military life. This was the climax.
Grown soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
It was a unique moment in American history. And such was the emotional quality of it that an old barracks room ballad, Old Soldiers Never Die, went to the top of the hit parade because General MacArthur had mentioned it. Von Monroe, for example, sold thousands of copies of his Victor record.
Fading away. Old soldiers never die, never die, never die. Old soldiers never die, they just fade away.
Now it is late June 1951. The emotion over General MacArthur will abate somewhat now because there is a new moment of drama. Its author is Jacob Malik, Russian delegate to the United Nations Security Council.
The Soviet peoples further believe that the most acute problem of the present day, the problem of the armed conflict in Korea, could also be settled. This would require the readiness of the parties to enter on the path of a peaceful settlement of the Korea question. The Soviet peoples believe that, as a first step, discussions should be started between the belligerents for a ceasefire and an armistice.
From the very beginning, the negotiations with the Chinese and North Korean communists proceeded with a bad limp. And at one juncture, they broke down completely. This is from a broadcast over the UN radio in Japan.
The armistice talks at Kaesong were declared, quote, off from this time, unquote, by the communists, following an alleged bombing attack on the conference site. The liaison officer's report, based on investigation on the spot but in darkness, clearly suggests the whole incident is a frame-up, staged from first to last.
By lying, evasion, and obstruction, the communists tried to see how far they could push us. But we would not accept the responsibility for ending the chances of peace, however slim these chances. Late in the year, a ceasefire line was agreed upon, and an order went down to the troops.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've just returned with the first notice of the ceasefire. I want to relay it to you so you can immediately get it to your platoons. There'll be no more raids by us. We send out no more combat patrols. Prior approval on a combat patrol, when it is sent out, will have to be approved by Corps level. Reconnaissance patrols will be utilized only to maintain contact with our enemy. We will fire only in self-defense and defense of the main line of resistance, or in the event the enemy starts building up a troop concentration to our front.
Was there actually a ceasefire order? Our highest officials told us no such order ever was issued. But you have just heard the evidence for yourselves. At any rate, the fact is that a comparative calm fell over the fighting front. But even in a comparative calm, men continue to die. We do not know when or whether there will be peace in Korea. We only know there is no peace in Korea now.
Thank you, Mr. Hicks. Most professional newsmen will tell you that the dismissal of General MacArthur was the biggest news story of the year. But that is not so in the borough of New York known as Brooklyn. We took our Voices and Events recording gear to Roey's Tavern, a Brooklyn neighborhood establishment on the corner of Clarkson and Rogers Streets. Our question, what do you think was the biggest news story of the year?
Well, I think the fact that the Brooklyns lost the pennant was about the biggest news story of the year because it pushed all the foreign news, the happenings in Korea and everything else off the front pages. Geez, I don't know what happened there. They were winning by so much and all of a sudden they blew it. The Giants must be a better team.
I know it's a story, brother. You're talking to a man that's practically gone home relief from it. I work in back of Ebbets Field. Brother, why went out and got a suit made up, tailor-made. The business went and the suit went.
I think it's the biggest story in New York. Oh, we were in the bag. We had it. We were 13 games ahead. Yeah. We couldn't lose. Well, Leo DeRocha showed us he moved from Brooklyn to New York, that's all.
Everyone in Roy's remembered the big day, the sad day, when Bobby Thompson hit that home run and made the Giants the National League champions.
I turned on the radio in the tailor shop, and they're bringing a new pitcher. And he said, Branca. And he pitched that second ball, and he hit it. I knew it was gone. And I'm from Brooklyn. After all, I was dejected. I was out, and I'm walking around with my head down now.
I was in the store, and Branca come in to pitch. And that was the blow. We had discussions. Well, each and every one had a different opinion, you know, what they should have done. They said, this guy's a bum. This guy's a bum. He didn't manage right. Then he used his head. Well, I was depressed. It was shocking.
Lost $75 that afternoon. I lost that game up in the Giants. I swooned. I fell over the bar. Damn near dead. My partner dropped dead. I give the guy the $75 back. He had already given it to me.
And there was another big baseball story this year. Joe DiMaggio, his place secure among baseball's immortals, announced his retirement. Listen to his curtain speech.
You all know I've had more than my share of physical injuries and setbacks during my career. In recent years, these have been too frequent to laugh off. When baseball is no longer fun, it's no longer a game. And so, I've played my last full game.
Now, another brief message from Mr. Randall.
I want to take just 1 minute, as this year slips away into history, to talk to the Traverse 13,000 employees and to our 40,000 agents and brokers throughout the United States and Canada. We have had another good year. In common with business in general, our companies have enjoyed a year of exceptional volume and growth. I am particularly pleased to report to you that we have put more new business on our books than at any single year in our 87-year history. This means many new friends for the Travers. It also means many new responsibilities for each of you who holds our company's destiny in trust. Through your skill, your experience, and your constant desire to serve, I know you will meet these new tests superbly. Now, may I wish each and every one of you a happy, healthy, and bounteous new year.
Thank you, Mr. Randall. Now here again is Robert Trout.
This was the year the United States took on the job of rearming not only itself, but the entire Western world. W.W. Chaplin has covered that story from the beginning of the year to the end. Mr. Chaplin.
This year, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization became more than a paper organization. A beginning was made toward transforming it into a formidable military organization. But, and this is a big but, it was only a beginning. The man chosen to head the NATO armies was General Dwight D. Eisenhower. Early in the year, immediately following his appointment, he took off for a flying tour of the NATO capitals in Europe.
I believe that this movement, among the Western democracies in which I now have been assigned a post, is one for the preservation of peace and nothing else. If it has a belligerent purpose or attitude, no one has expressed that to me, and I would think it would be defeated from the start. I'm leaving here at noon on Saturday to make an exploratory trip. I hope to visit every capital of every nation. And among the purposes of that visit will be to reassure myself that I am not working at cross purposes with anybody, but that in every capital is shared my belief in what we're trying to do and my convictions as to what must be done if it's to be a success.
I was the only reporter who accompanied General Eisenhower through every stop of that frenzied tour. France, Belgium, England, the Low Countries, Scandinavia, Italy, and Luxembourg. In the larger capitals, there was carefully planned communist opposition to NATO and to Ike, but it melted to a mere muted snarl under the overwhelming cheers of the vast majority. I think Ike started that tour with crossed fingers, but he ended it with full confidence that the West would rally to his leadership. General Eisenhower returned home to find a great debate in progress over the extent of America's role in world preparedness. Listen to Senator Hickenlooper sparring with Secretary of State Dean Acheson during the hearings.
Well, I'm trying to find out whether this is only the camel getting its head under the tent and whether the four divisions will require six more and then the ten will require 12 more and where we're going, what we have to look forward to. I'm wondering where the end of this matter is and whether or not in the long run we will be put into the inevitable position of assuming the primary responsibility for the land defense of Europe.
Well, Senator, I think you're asking me quite impossible questions. I don't know. Well, in the first place, you say, are we going to be asked to take over the land defense of Europe? The answer is, of course we're not going to be asked to take over the land defense of Europe. If you ask me whether in the future you may be asked to send more than six divisions, how can I possibly answer that? I suppose if there's war, you will. Maybe if the situation gets better, it will be less. Maybe if it stays the same, it'll be the same. Maybe if it gets more tense, there may be some additions to it. This is quite out of my field. I'm not able to tell you.
The administration defined this as a military problem, but that did nothing to mitigate congressional opposition to Secretary Acheson. The late Senator Wherry, a casualty of the year, was one of those most strongly opposed.
A large percentage of the people know, in view of the present precarious international situation, with its terrific impact upon our domestic economy, that Dean Acheson has failed miserably as Secretary of State. The Republican members of the Senate and House adopted a resolution saying, Mr. Acheson has lost the confidence of the American people and Mr. Acheson must go.
As the year ends, Secretary Acheson still holds office, and friends of the administration may point to our growing strength as evidence that his policies are paying off. Part of that growing strength is in the increased potential of our atomic weapons. What you are hearing now is the actual sound of an atomic explosion early this year in the Nevada desert. This dramatic explosion rocked the walls of Las Vegas gambling houses. It broke windows and crockery. But the men of the American Far West are sturdy men, not easily perturbed even by an atomic bomb. Here is this one.
Well, I was making my rounds about 5:45. Got a blinding flash in the eye and I batted my eyes about like a toad would in a hailstorm. I raised my head and looked up to the west and north and I see a big white sheet hanging in the sky, so I just surmised then that must be the atomic bomb.
Following the Nevada atom tests, there was guarded talk of atomic artillery and of other secret atomic weapons suitable for tactical use on the battlefield. We were cautioned that such developments are still some time off. Our actual battle strength is still in conventional weapons and in the foot soldiers who use them. The growing NATO force in Europe is still small in numbers, but it is well-equipped and physically hard. These are maneuvers near the Czechoslovakian border. The men who covered them for us are Charlie and Gene Jones, the fabulous TV cameraman.
The sergeant is giving some orders to his tank crew.
Range, 1-200. Tank. Fire.
Our M-26 tank, mounting a 90mm rifle, has just opened fire upon the aggressive forces. A
That's our 50 caliber atop the tank. Opening fire. The aggressive force is on dispersing. We're laying down a very fine field of fire on the aggressive force.
Here comes one of our troopers now. He's coming over. What is your name, buddy?
Private Hill.
What outfit are you in, Private?
First Division.
What do you think about this situation? Is the division ready?
Well, we're pretty close to the Czechoslovakia border, and I think if they ever came over here, the Russians, we'd give them a good battle, just like they are over in Korea.
Here at home, for the first time in history, we sent troops in after an atomic explosion. They were astonished, perhaps, but unafraid.
We were seated on the ground and told to face away from the blast. From the time we saw the flash, it was about 25 seconds till we heard the blast. They counted off the seconds and then said, bombs away. It was a terrific blast. I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was really something to see. The clouds started when you first seen the fireball, the clouds sort of looked like a donut and rose up and spread out all over and drifted over by us. Well, I couldn't say how high, but it must have been a mile wide anyway.
As this year ends, it could be said that the most notable fact is a negative one. We have still managed to avoid another great world war. The pessimistic may point to the many setbacks, the delays, the tax burdens, which it is hard to balance with achievements already gained. But the more hopeful see the horizon brightening ahead of us. One of these is Secretary Acheson. In a pre-Christmas news conference, he said that Europeans have made more progress toward unity in the past 4 years than they did in the previous five centuries. Both the pessimists and the optimists can make telling points from the record, but the weight of evidence would seem to lie with the more hopeful. The gain to date has perhaps not been great, but a start has been made. A foundation has been laid on which a permanent structure of security and peace can, with goodwill, be built.
Thank you, Mr. Chaplin. And now we have one more major story left to tell. It's a story that begins with a question. Who is going to be the next president of the United States? Democratic Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois outlined the qualifications he thinks a man should have to run for the job of president.
The job is really an impossible job, and it calls for the brooding qualities of Lincoln, the philosophic depth of Jefferson, the sturdiness of Cleveland, the daring of Franklin D. Roosevelt, and the popular leadership qualities of Theodore Roosevelt. In addition, he must be a spiritual leader. He needs the patience of Job, and must have the physique either of a Sandow, a Samson, or a Charles Atlas. Any man who wants to be president of the United States ought to have his head examined.
Fortunately for the future of our country, there are a number of people who, in Senator Douglas's terms, ought to have their heads examined. One such is Mr. Republican, Senator Robert Taft.
I am going to run because I believe I can conduct the only kind of campaign which will elect a Republican to office. I do not underestimate the difficulties of electing a Republican president against the automatic propaganda of a great administration machine supported by taxpayers' money. But I am convinced that a great majority of the American people today believe fundamentally in those principles which the Republican Party can present to them. I feel confident, therefore, that I will be nominated and elected.
Republican Governor Earl Warren of California is offering himself as a compromise candidate for the Republican nomination.
Republicans must search for common ground on which we can stand. This is no time to disagree on small things or to break up on the rocks of personal interest. There is a great field for solid agreement and solid accomplishment among Republicans without sacrificing the principles or conscience of anyone. I shall try to be helpful in this regard.
The third Republican candidate officially in the field is Harold Stassen.
I will present to the people the platform which I fervently believe that America should adopt in 1952, and I will give my approval on that platform for the presentation of my name as a candidate for president in 1952.
In addition, there is support for such men as New Jersey Governor Alfred Driscoll, Illinois Senator Everett Dirksen, and Oregon Senator Wayne Morse. But it was for New York's Governor Thomas E. Dewey to make the announcement early in the year that a great number of Republicans awaited.
I am definitely and finally removed. I removed myself by a letter
That's about 18 months ago, and that is beyond consideration. I would recommend to the New York delegation that they support General Eisenhower for president if he would accept the draft.
Jack Begon, NBC correspondent in Rome, reported on good authority that General Eisenhower will announce his candidacy during the forthcoming NATO meeting in Portugal. Pennsylvania Senator James Duff has already opened Eisenhower for President headquarters, and he thinks he's found his campaign platform in the news of the past year.
The present party in power in Washington has become corrupt, and it is imperative at a time when America exercise the leadership of the world, that we stand for honest government as well as liberal government. And the present administration is tagged with the fact that there's been rottenness all through it. And therefore, we must have a change.
Many leading Republicans feel they have winning issues for 1952 in the government scandals and in administration handling of Far Eastern policy and the MacArthur affair. But President Truman opened his political defense for 1952 recently when he addressed the Women's Democratic Clubs in Washington.
I venture to predict that there's going to be more money spent in trying to defeat the Democratic Party next year than has ever before been spent in any election in the history of this republic. And that's not all. The opposition is sure to be fully equipped with slick public relations counselors and gigantic national advertising campaigns. The art of misrepresentation can be expected to reach new heights, if that's possible.
None of the Democratic candidates for 1952 is out in the open. Straws in the wind point to such men as Chief Justice Fred Vinson, Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver, Georgia Senator Richard Russell, James A. Farley, and Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. But what about President Harry Truman? Senator Paul Douglas, making it clear that he himself does not want to be president, expressed this opinion on Harry Truman.
Well, I would not say that he is a candidate, but I think that he is underneath the mistletoe and that he is in a position to be kissed, so to speak, by the various Democratic leaders who go in to see him. If he is nominated, I will support him.
And so the story of politics in 1951 must end the same way it began, with a question. Who will be the next president of the United States? I, for one, will make no predictions. The news of 1951 is not a completed story. Events will not halt for a New Year's Eve celebration and make a new start on New Year's Day. The revelations of national scandal will continue. The Korean War is not over. Our job of rearmament is only begun. Prices continue to rise, and new presidential candidates will throw their hats into the ring. Who will be the next president? As usual, the NBC News and Special Events Department will sit up all the night of November the 4th, election night, to bring you the story. We hope you will be with us.
Now, as we bring this Traveler's presentation of Voices and Events 1951 to a close, the whole Traveler's family wishes all of you the very best for 1952.
This transcribed presentation of Voices and Events 1951 was produced by Joseph O. Myers, written and directed by Jack Gerber, and this is Robert Trout wishing you a grand year ahead.